From KALW, San Francisco, and PRX, this is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Think back to when you were 14 years old. Do you remember when you were 14? Do you remember what your goals were at the age of 14? What was my goal when I was 14? I don't know, achieve perfect bangs and not use too much hair product. Well, here's what Bonnie Simi wanted to do.
So I said, I want to be in the Olympics. I said I wanted to be an ABC TV reporter. I wanted to go to a good college. I wanted to be a pilot. And then I wanted to build a log cabin.
Yeah, not exactly the same as good hair goals. And her list got her on Oprah. I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad here. Bonnie wasn't born with a silver spoon in her mouth with everything handed to her.
My mother used to take us to the airport. It was cheap entertainment for kids. She couldn't afford babysitters. So we would sit, while she was grading papers because she was a school teacher, we'd sit in the lobby area of this small airport, and we'd watch the airplanes take off and land.
And it's not like she was just given a spot on an Olympic team.
I saw an ad to be a torchbearer in the 1980 Olympics, and I thought, well, that's kind of being an Olympian, carry the torch.
Okay, well, maybe she went to a school for broadcasters.
I originally wanted to be an engineer.
Alrighty then. You know what? Let's just talk to her. Bonnie Simi, the most interesting woman in the world. Okay, so here you are,
mm-hmm.
A grown woman. And how many of those goals have you now accomplished?
Let's see. I did go to college, so I went to Stanford. And then ultimately ended up majoring in broadcast journalism. One of the teachers there, I was going to go as an engineer. That was my main path. But then you have to take in college those breadth classes, you know, that to expand your mind. And I took this class in film, and I just was fascinated by it. And then, you know, that little thing in the back of my mind, hey, there's this broadcast thing that you do want to be at work for ABC TV. Maybe I'll take a few more classes around that. And then ultimately I switched out of engineering and into broadcast journalism and ultimately eventually worked for ABC. In the middle of that, I did end up competing in the Olympics. And that's how I ended up working for ABC TV. Ultimately, actually here in San Francisco for KGO TV, which was, that was my first television job. And then after working at the television station, I was finally earning money. I wasn't the starving college kid anymore. And so I decided, this list, which hadn't been overly top of mind, it was there, but it wasn't super top of mind. But now I'm already thinking, hey, I'm marketing down this list. I need to do this pilot thing. And I've really always wanted to be a pilot. And so my vision of becoming a pilot was to fly a small airplane. So I saved some money and I literally went down to the local airport and said, I want to learn to fly. And I did. So I became a pilot, which eventually led to me deciding over the course of time that I would prefer to be a pilot than a television broadcaster, and then made that into a profession. So that's four. And then the fifth one, the log cabin. Yeah, I haven't built the log cabin yet, but you got to save something for retirement. I did build our house, but my husband now keeps saying, honey, when we retire, I've got to build that log cabin. He says, honey, don't you know that's not practical? We don't need a log cabin. So I don't know. I mean, it'll happen, though. I just don't know how big of a log cabin. Maybe for my dog.
I have a great set of Lincoln logs at home.
Yes. I did use Lincoln logs as a kid. Maybe that's where that log cabin came from.
That's it. So, okay. So, you know, in just a few minutes, you were able to tick off, you know, the four of the five things mm-hmm. that you came up with when you were 14. And I know that it couldn't have been, it's not like it was a straight path between, mm-hmm. like, you made the list and then you set off to do these things and you had blinders on and that's all you were focused on doing. But you did manage to do all of these things. So was the list, like, on your wall? Do you carry it with you wherever you go? Or what role did that really play for you?
In fact, I wish I still had the actual written list. I don't. I think that, you know, in high school, the two things that it was really, really driving me was I wanted to get into a good college. And I figured the only way I was going to do it with it was with a sports scholarship, because we literally had no money. And so I was very passionate, and I was a field hockey player. And I figured that field hockey would be my way to the Olympics. And it ultimately was my way to college. It paid for my college. And I was working my way up through the field hockey ranks. And then I saw an ad to be a torchbearer in the 1980 Olympics. I applied. There was one from every state. I was the California person, and I brought the flame to Lake Placid. And that's where I saw, way back, so this was now 1980. So I had seen the 1976 Olympics with the camera mounted on the bobsled. And I'm like, oh, look at the bobsled. So I went to go watch the bobsled races. And one of the other torchbearers was a bobsledder. And I said, how can I do that? I want to try that. And he said, women are not allowed to bobsled. They were actually internationally banned from bobsledding, because the International Bobsled Federation at that time said that bobsledding would hurt females' reproductive organs, and so they were not allowed to bobsled. So
how considerate.
Yeah, how considerate. So he said, but you can try luge, which was a similar sport, lying on your back feet first. So that's how I ended up into the sport of luge. And there was a beginner's camp right after the Olympics. I had taken a quarter off from school, from Stanford, to go to the Olympics. So I had school didn't start for a month. I had a month with nothing to do and no money to do it with. And they had this luge camp for $8. And a hotel that I was staying at, they needed somebody to help clean up after the Olympics because it was trashed. And so I stayed at the hotel, cleaned it, they fed me, and I did the luge camp. And one thing led to another. And the coaches said, if you do very well, you could be very good at this sport, you need to go to Germany. And right at that same time, I got a call from Levi's that I had won a one of those boxes you go into a store and you stuff it with like your name and stuff. Yeah.
Like a contest?
Like a contest. There were 1.8 million people. And my name was drawn out. And it was $5,000 to be the best you can be in whatever. And I said, I want to be the best luge athlete. So I bought a plane ticket to Germany and proceeded to crash over and over and over again. So when you talk of hardships, I was not a natural born luger. I went to this track in Germany and I was training with the Germans, and they thought, well, I must be one of the best Americans because I came all the way from there. And I wasn't. I didn't even know who the best Americans were. So they put me from the top. You don't go from the top when you're new. I crashed.
You mean the top of the mountain?
The top of the hill, the luge track, yeah. Okay. And I crashed 52 times in a row. And my arms were so swollen, they were shiny. And I would have gone home. I would have quit. And this whole story, you wouldn't be talking to me now because I wouldn't have probably headed down the path. But there was something in me that said, you know, if you can get through this, if you could just get down once, then you might make it. And then you could get down twice. And then then the other side of me said, look, just go home. But I had a non-refundable plane ticket. So with a certain day, I'm like, I got to stick this out for 3 months. So I'm going to do it and I'm going to make it down once. And ultimately I did. And the Germans, so I spent 3 months training with the German national team. So when I got back, I did pretty well with the Americans. So in the end of the day, it was one of those, I had said it enough to enough people that I wanted some to be in the Olympics, that because I was really headed down that path on field hockey, that I said, look, I can't quit. Right? I just can't quit. I could if I get to a point where I'm just not capable, okay. If I get to a point where I race and I'm just not good enough, okay. But I can't just walk away on my own volition and say no. So. And then again, there was that non-refundable ticket.
So pragmatic. So could you just describe a luge track? And also just, is the luge the thing that you actually sit in? Some fundamentals here, just so we know what you were in for.
A luge sled is, you lie on your back, you go feet first, goes about 85 miles an hour.
And you're by yourself? Or
yes, you're by yourself. Uh-huh. by yourself, and you steer the sled, kind of flexing it with your legs. So think of the old-fashioned flexi flyers where you lie on your stomach and you steer it with your hands. It's similar size sled, much more souped up, of course, and you're lying on your back going feet first. So that's what the sport is. It is not a sport for daredevils. It is a sport where you actually need to have a lot of composure and precision, because you're going 85 miles an hour with walls that are only like 6 inches on either side of you. So you have to steer, and it's extremely steerable. It's at that speed, it's much more steerable than a car. So you have to be very, very precise. So it's kind of like Formula One racing, and that sort of feel vibe is how it is.
So that just sounds terrifying to me.
It's good character building. It's very good character building.
What do you think appealed to you? Like, would you do that now?
Well, I still do it.
You still do it?
And I still, yeah, they have the Masters races. And whenever they come out to say, there's a track, it was Lake Placid. It was the only track in the U.S. Now they also have one in Park City because of the 2002 Olympics. And we used to live in Park City. So I would go every couple of years. It's the Masters is in Park City. And I dust off my old sled and I take a couple of runs. And yeah, it's fun. I don't go from the top anymore, but it's a sport. It's I really encourage people to watch it on the Olympics, and they're always recruiting kids, so you never know.
You never know. But so, what appeals to you about that?
I think there's a certain level of the rush, obviously, but it is a sport where you can have that high speed rush, but it's not really dangerous. It's not like Formula One racing, NASCAR. I had a very good friend who raced in NASCAR, and she was trying to get more women in NASCAR, and she said, look, you'd be great in that. So I went out one of the local tracks here to do one of those car course programs, race car, and I didn't like it. It was a little scary for me. I don't like skydiving, those kinds of things. So it's the type of thing where you can get that rush without it being overly dangerous. And I also very much like the precision, the mental side of it. It's extremely mentally challenging.
So when you became interested in flying, mm-hmm. now you're not 4 inches off the ground, you're 10,000 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. When you sat in that cockpit for the first time, what was the experience like for you?
I remember walking into the flight school, and I literally didn't know anything about aviation. And I just wanted to learn. And somebody told me, just go take 3 lessons. After 3 lessons, that's a nice little milestone. You'll know what you're getting into. And if you like, and that's something I encourage anyone, just go to your local airport, walk in the door. There's a flight school there. Take 3 lessons. So I walked in and signed up with an instructor, and I got in the airplane, which was a very small Cessna 152, two-seater trainer. And I remember looking at the dials and gauges on the cockpit and thinking, oh my gosh, this is so complicated. I'll never get it. And the radio, so you talk in aviation speak, if you will, and I couldn't even pick out one word from the next. So I thought, wow, what am I getting myself into? But it really very quickly becomes very natural, and it's not unlike the sport of luge, per se. It's precision, it's calmness under pressure. It's always changing. Things are, you know, whether it's weather or whatever. And it is a community. So the pilot community is an ecosystem that is, I enjoy the pilot community just like I enjoy the community of Olympic athletes.
And so you obviously made it through the 3 lessons to the point where you got a job as a pilot at United?
Yes.
And you were flying at the time of the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, I was. I was a captain on 737s at the time.
Mm-hmm. And you kept flying.
Yeah. So I had, at the time, now remember going back to that bobsled thing, I was kind of fixated on bobsled very young and such. Ultimately, we did get bobsled into the Olympics in the 2002 Olympics, and I had retired from luge at that point. So 1992 was my last Olympics. And then I got married, had a kid, I was an airline pilot, and I was helping women's bobsled, helping them campaign to get it in the Olympics while I was a pilot. And ultimately, we succeeded. And then I thought, you know, I'd really like to do a comeback. And so I was actually, and United was great. They're Olympic sponsor, they were, and they still are. And I got some time off to train. So I had just in early September, I had taken some time off because this was, of course, the Olympic year, right? So September 2001 was leading into the February 2002 Olympics. So it was the Olympic season. So I was off training for the Olympics. And I just finished the leave, or was just off on a leave of absence right when that happened. And of course, I knew some of those pilots personally. So it was very personal. And I also knew that because I was fairly well known at United, both the employees as well as some of the public because of my bobsled, I just felt that it would be important to get back in the cockpit. And I still remember that it was the very first day when I was flying, and I was flying, it was San Francisco, Tucson. And a flight attendant came up to me and said, so good to see you here. You're a mother, right? And I said, yes, I'm a mother. And she said, you wouldn't be here if you didn't feel safe, right? And I said, that's right. And I said, it's important. And I said, I feel safe. The procedures that have been put in place, I feel safe. So that's why I decided to come back and fly. And I flew for a couple of weeks, and then, you know, and then I went back into training.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. I'm talking with Bonnie Simi, the president of JetBlue Technology Ventures. Well, I'd love to talk about being female while piloting.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Because I don't know what the ratio – do you know what the ratio
is
now?
Yeah, it's about 5%.
It's 5%. Mm-hmm. So you – and you mentioned that you were part of the group that was pushing to get bobsledding into the Olympics mm-hmm. for women. Mm-hmm. So have you thought about being a pilot – or the airline industry in those same kinds of terms?
I think, you know, it's funny because over the course of my career, you know, whether it be being a female sports reporter in the 80s, which obviously that's a male-dominated industry, and, you know, being an airline pilot, very few women, particularly in the 90s, that were pilots, bobsled, I'm a venture capitalist, there's not a lot of women in venture capital. I don't go into these fields because they're male-dominated and I want to break down some barrier or anything. That's just not how I'm wired. I'm wired to do it because it's something that I think I can be good at and I like. I follow my passion. And you know what? The airplane doesn't know if you're a male or a female. The bobsled doesn't know that. And so you just do it. And, oh, by the way, I happen to be a female. So I'm a venture capitalist. And, oh, by the way, I happen to be female. Same thing as a sports reporter. And I that's how I approach it. And it's just been very successful. I am also aware that for some people, they like to see others do it. So if I'm out there doing what I'm following my heart and following my passion and following my skills so I'm good at something, that then can help others see that, yes, you can do it. There, people say, oh, there's these barriers. Well, yeah, it may be a little harder sometimes, but if you put your heart and soul into it, you can do it.
Well, have you ever been in a situation as you have progressed throughout your career where you felt like you deserved a promotion or you didn't go for one for some reason because you didn't think you were ready, or a situation where if you look back on it, you think, oh, I wish I had handled that differently, or I wish they had handled that differently?
Well, yes, and I still remember I had a boss many, many years ago, and, you know, I was up and coming, and I was, you know, charging and ambitious and all this stuff, and when you have that kind of personality, you always think that you're ready for promotion before you really are, and that's not gender specific. That's just, you know, anyone. And so I remember that my boss said, you will know when you're ready for, really, truly ready for promotion, when you're pushed from below, cheered from aside, from the side, and pulled from above. And he said, you need to work on all three of those. And that's advice I tell, you know, many times, because then later on I became head of talent at JetBlue. So I had many, many, many interviews and many, many, many folks at JetBlue, again, not gender specific, who would come, who, you know, managers who wanted to become directors, who would say, why am I not being promoted? And so I'd kind of say that same thing. And I think then where the challenge for women then is, how do you think about all three of those elements? Often, pushed from below, they will be pushed from below because women, you know, are great leaders, really are. So they're empathetic and such. This cheering from the side can be a challenge sometimes, right? And so making sure and building those networks. And that probably is the hardest, really, is building the networks at your peer level. And then the pull from above, and this is where the whole concept of, you know, sponsorship, and it's great if there are female leaders higher than you in the organization, but actually most of the folks that were the ones pulling me from above, because at JetBlue there, they would have female leaders there, but not very many. It is an airline with not a lot of women, but now that's different. But is, you know, I would make sure that I was visible and I would lean in. Did I get promoted when I thought I should be? I don't know. But I don't, that's certainly not a gender issue. I think it's, like I said, you have to wait your time and you need to be cheered from all three sides.
What are your suggestions in terms of building a network? What does that mean?
I think, you know, it's, and this is particularly if you're a mom, or a caregiver in some way, shape or form, when you're at work, you don't do a great job. That's obviously table stakes. But you also need to help others around you, not for the sake of getting a promotion or whatever, but just for doing it the right thing and just making a good workplace. But that's giving additional discretionary energy. And sometimes that, for women, that discretionary energy, you're saving it for your family because there's just so much, there's only so much energy you have in your well when you wake up in the morning. And so it can be a little harder, but it is reaching out. And it is a cross, and it's not just reaching out for other women. It's reaching out for men or people of color, whatever, you know, to build that peer group that is supportive and just going out of your way. Because you know what? If you go out of your way for your fellow coworkers, they're going to go out of their way for you.
You strike me as someone who's very goal-oriented. Mm-hmm. You set the goal, achieve it. Was there ever a time when you had to just say, this is not working out? And as they say in your biz, pivot.
Pivot. Well, let's see. I think being one of the toughest times for me was when I did do the comeback for bobsled. And I was favored to win a medal in the Olympics and everything. And I put my heart and soul into it. And this is one of the biggest leadership lessons I ever learned, and in part kind of how I've become wired the way I am in terms of leadership. So the bobsled driver is the leader of the team. And I made decisions for the team. I didn't always take into consideration the needs or the opinions of some of the members on my team, and of which I had a very diverse team. And one particular woman, wonderful gal, she's a woman of color, and I had made a decision and she didn't agree with it, but instead of us discussing it, she just moved over to another team, which ultimately they won the gold medal. I didn't even make the team.
What was the decision?
That was definitely the comeback. Well, she needed some, she was injured, and I just, you know, I thought it would be best for her to take some time off. And she didn't want to take the time off. But I didn't ask. That's the biggest point. The lesson that I'm getting at is, even if it may have been the right decision, and I'm not saying it was, I didn't understand her perspective. And I think it was magnified in the differences of, you know, on the racial differences as well. And it was the biggest leadership mistake I ever made. And she was right to leave my team. And so these are those things where it's like understanding people's perspective as a leader is so important. And that was my biggest mistake and leadership lesson that I carry forever.
So that must have been so disappointing.
That was a very disappointing, because for me, you know, I'd given my heart and soul to that Olympic, and it was a goal I did not achieve, right? I came back from Luge. So Luge, I had finished sixth, was my highest. So I came back into bobsled because I wanted to win an Olympic medal. I wanted, that was the, and I didn't. And so that was when I'm like, okay, so what do I do next? I'm, you know, a pilot, I'm a mom. It was just a very sort of downtime, and I thought maybe I'll go leave aviation. I mean, it was a tough time for United at the time as well. They were in bankruptcy. And do I just go run a nonprofit, run the Olympic Committee, or do something else? And that's when I did a lot of soul searching. So it was, you know, ultimately I decided to, you know, make a transition and move over to JetBlue and do management work. But it was a tough time to make those decisions. That's, you know, and it stemmed out of the not making the Olympic team.
Well, I'd love to talk about your relationship with your mom a little, if that's okay. And you told me that she was a single mom, but I've also heard you talk about the fact that you didn't have much money and that she was disabled in some way. And I mean, I don't have any of the details on that, but I was just wondering if you'd be willing to just talk about your mom growing up with her, what you learned from her and how her outlook and how that affected yours.
So, I look back and now my mom has since passed. But when I look back, you know, I had my daughter when I was 35 years old. My mom had me when she was 19. I can't even imagine being a parent at 19. And then, you know, she became a single mom of two and then eventually three kids when she was 23. And so how do you raise a family and make sure there's food on the table and all of this? So she was a school teacher. And I think that, you know, part of it, she taught kindergarten through third grade. And so I had really good education. Obviously, I wasn't in her class. I was in a different school district. But yeah, mom knew how to teach reading right away. So I read when I was really young and all of those kinds of things. So I very much attribute that. As shortly thereafter, I would say when I was about 10, she got early stages of multiple sclerosis, which wasn't diagnosed for quite some time, but she lost her driver's license, which was a challenge because we lived in the mountains and she was, and it turns out there's a California law, if you're the only child, you live more than 10 miles from public transportation and neither parent can drive, you can get a driver's license at 14. So I was the driver and sort of took on that. And then ultimately she had to spend a lot of time in the hospital. And so I was kind of raising my two brothers. But through all of that, as I was also doing sports and she would always encourage me. Then she retired, medically retired, but she was the greatest cheerleader through the Olympics. So when I came home, well, actually, when I came home with that list of the goals, she didn't say, "That's crazy," or "What are you doing?" or "You can't do that." She said, "So how are you going to do it?" Which is kind of an interesting way of thinking about it, kind of puts you in that forward, that lean in, that Sheryl Sandberg lean in.
Way before Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah, and so how are you going to do it? So I've always had that, okay, if a problem comes up, it's not, I can't do that. It's, well, how can I? How can I? And I'll maybe go around it, go over it. And you think of it as a forward thinking. And I think that was my mom. She never held me back. She never held me back. Even when I applied to colleges and she did say, "We can't afford college." But I said, "You know, I want to get a scholarship." She says, "Great, let's apply," you know. So she was really supportive. And then I think she also taught me a lot of lessons in much later in life. And as she was becoming more and more disabled, and now I was moving up in my professional. I was at JetBlue. I was moving up into the executive ranks, and you know, I had a daughter who was, you know, 8, and I had a mom who was in and out of hospital. So I was doing this sort of care balance plus work, and anybody who says work-life balance, and I think there was work-life balance over life, not necessarily at any given time. But there were some choices I had to make when, you know, mom had to go in the hospital and various things, and I said, you know, you only have one mom. So I did slow down a little bit in some areas at work, and you know, didn't take some moves that I might have for a while. And I don't regret that at all, because I think my mom deserves that. I think parents put so much into their kids, and then that's time when kids give back to their parents. And it's just something that'll live with me forever, that I did well by my mom, because she did well by me.
Bonnie, what's the best advice that you've been given about how to dream?
You have to have a dream for a dream to come true. A lot of people don't dream.
So how do you have that dream?
So if I said to you right now, if you had no obstacles and you were guaranteed to succeed, what goal would you set for yourself? Especially as you get later in life, people just put too many boundaries on things. They say, "Well, I can't do that. I can't do that." Let's just assume you have no boundaries. Money isn't an issue. Relationships aren't an issue. Location isn't an issue. What, and you knew you were going to be successful, what would you do? And that's where you get to that, your passion. Like, you have to follow your heart. Some people always want to be an Olympian or something. But some people maybe always want to be a poet. Somebody, you know, it doesn't matter. Go think. And once you have it, I'm not saying you have to go do it now. I mean, I say go try this exercise now. But whatever that goal was or series of goals, it can be a discovery, because you can do that a couple of times. And then it helps you take off all the layers of, I can't, or you can't, and get down to what does your heart say? What is it you want? And I don't think people do that enough.
So bonus question then, how do you view failure?
Well, yes, and this is a lesson that I learned as a young, I was a ski racer. So when I grew up, I lived in this mountain town, it was a ski town, and all the kids could ski for free up to age 14. So I skied practically every day after school and all this stuff. And so I was on the ski team. And I remember going down to the gates, and it was perfect. I was so excited. It was my first time hitting the line perfectly.
How old are you?
I was about 12. And I went to the coach, and I walked up to him. I was all proud of myself, and he said, "That was terrible." And I said, "What did I do wrong?" And he said, "You did it 3 times." And I said, "Yeah." And all 3 were really good runs. And he says, you didn't fall. You didn't crash. I said, "Okay, why would I want to crash?" And he said, "Because if you don't push yourself and push the envelope in training and fail, you will never succeed in a race because you won't know how far you can go."
Wow. That is a really good lesson. And at 12.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that stuck with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The words that I would use to describe Bonnie Simi sound like something that would come out of a leadership manual. Grit, audacity, humility, and generosity toward others. But this is what that stuff looks like in a real person. So the next time we find ourselves in a challenging situation, maybe we should just ask, what would Bonnie do? This is How Women Rise Up. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point. Your contribution helps bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you'll be rewarded, thanks to EO Body Care, Bel Campo Meat, Farm Girl Flowers, and Three Twins Ice Cream for providing our patron rewards. Check them out on our contribute page at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is brought to you in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Radio Public, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review. We'd love that. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. And I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.